You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
You're very welcome along to Tuesday's OTB AM. It's Owen and Anthony Moyles here with you until around 9:15 this morning, and plenty coming up, as you can imagine. We're still picking through some of the big stories from the weekend of sport. We'll be talking rugby, we'll be talking football, we'll be talking GAA as well. There's still some stuff to pick through from what happened at Congress and on the pitch at the weekend. And we'll be touching on boxing as well a little bit later on in the company of Gareth A. Davies as well. If you've got any comments at all, you can tweet us at Off The Ball. Anthony Moyles, a very good morning to you.
Morning, Owen. How are you doing?
Not too bad. It seems that every time we're in studio, we start to, you know, hand out awards or rank footballers or anything like that. And this morning is no different. We're going to decide who the manager of the year so far is in football, because John Fogarty has mentioned in the Irish Examiner this morning a couple of names. Who first comes to your mind when I say who's been manager of the year so far?
I'd have to plug for my own county man. he's done a very good job. So I would definitely say Andy has done very, very well. I think Mickey Graham has done a very good job in Cavan. Difficult situation for him coming in there, obviously, with the success of the club stuff. So there was a lot of talk about him already. Smart lad, knows the system well, and I think he has brought him on. People would say there's a bit of pedigree there, obviously, from their underage success. But at the same time, I would have been worried about him. You know, first job, first time with him, and he went to Division 1 in the league. But he's done really, really well. Like, I mean, they haven't got any kind of hammerings. You know, they've been thereabouts in every game. And I think he has done a really, really good job. And he's expanding the Cavan kind of blueprint that was there, which was very, very defensive. You know, a lot of men behind the ball, trying to counter-attack. But he has really expanded that, you know. And he's got a good few lads to come back as regards players. Who else? Gallagher in Fermanagh.
Yeah, he's got to be up there.
Yeah.
Also because he gets such a hard time as well.
And maybe, he does. He gets plenty of stick.
Some would say it's still justified, and maybe they'll take a heavy beating to someone they shouldn't in the summer and we'll suddenly revise everything we've said. But you look at where they're sitting at the moment and you have to say he's one of the contenders for an incredible job up there in 6 points just behind your own Meath at the moment.
Yeah, but I think he kind of... I don't really know the fella that well. I've played against him numerous times, but I think he revels in that kind of, the world is against us type of role, it seems, you know, and as does it seems. You know, when he was with Donegal, I'd say he was heavily involved in that kind of siege mentality. And he, you know, it's both the way he approaches, say, shall we say, media or detractors or people who question him, and also the way he obviously sets his teams up. He kind of says, listen, this is just the way we're going to do it. And I suppose he's a pragmatic manager at the same time. But there's no doubt about it. He can pick holes in teams and he can see what works and what doesn't work. Obviously, he intimately knows Donegal. Like, I mean, the result of the weekend was a great result for them. Mm. And, like, I mean, they're sitting pretty now. You don't fancy playing them. They're always a very, very difficult team to play against because they have good forwards, but then they will set up in such a way, obviously, that it will just frustrate.
You know? You'd wonder as well how tough it must be to actually stay strong in the belief of the football that you're playing when it's been criticised roundly, especially because it's been criticised so much at times earlier on in this league campaign. And we're not actually seeing the Division 2 game, so we're actually trusting people who are saying they're playing a putrid brand of football.
Yeah.
And what pundits are actually saying actually has an added impact because, you know, the public aren't able to make their own mind up because they haven't been able to see Fermanagh games in full.
Correct, but as a manager, yes, there's an added pressure with that, but what you need to then make sure is that you're actually getting results, which he is getting. So that eases the pressure from him. You know, he can say, listen, don't mind everyone out there. You know, let's have a look at the league table. That's the important part, lads. You know, so some of you may feel that we need to play a more expansive role. Some of you may feel that the role you're playing isn't ideal to what you're used to. But at the same time, we're getting the results and we're competing with the bigger boys. So that's you know, the proof is in the pudding.
We can see them flying high there at the top of Division 2 at the moment, Meath and Fermanagh. You would have got good odds on that at the start of the year. Obviously, still relatively early with Kildare and Donegal, who I'd imagine at the start of the year were favourites to go back up, so they get it together.
Look at them, you know, 35 scores against, you know. So, like, the lowest by a decent shot. You know, next one is Kildare, who've conceded 45.
Yeah.
So that's the blueprint. Now, they haven't scored a whole pile. They've only scored 40. But at the same time, That is the blueprint for them. You know, so the idea is that they frustrate the living daylights out of you and look to cut. And I think, you know, again, look what he's dealing with. You know, the club situation and the playing population. Like, I mean, it's extremely difficult for him. I was reading an article yesterday about just even the resources and the finances up there. Like, it's an absolutely fair play to him. Like, I mean, it would have been. Imagine the rhetoric if he was at the bottom of the league going into Division 3. No one would kind of go, oh, that's a surprise. You know, people would be kind of saying, well, it's Fermanagh. And I'm not mean, that's no disrespect to Fermanagh, but, you know, to see them up there and pushing for Division 1 football is absolutely brilliant for him.
For sure. So, like, we've got Graham, we've got McEntee, we've got Gallagher. We should actually put up a Twitter poll. Now, you've got a maximum of 4 options on a Twitter poll, Anthony. So choose wisely here with the rest of your nominees.
Oh, maximum of 4. Come on. I've two to go through. I think Terry Hyland has done a pretty fantastic job. And I would also go with Wayne Cairns in Loud.
Yeah.
Like, I know we were chatting about him and you said you interviewed him.
Yeah, he was on the Saturday panel a few weeks ago, which you can watch back. A very interesting guy and has a soccer background, which, as you've been saying, is so important in Loud.
I think it is important in Loud. Like, I mean, you know, Dundalk and Drogheda, you know, two big strongholds, massive towns, and there is a serious pull towards soccer. You know, there is a serious pull towards soccer. There's many a young lad in Loud who wouldn't even think of Gaelic. Mm. You know, they just it's there, but it's all the focus is on soccer. And I think it's a very smart move. I didn't know, like you were saying, that he has a bit of a crossover with the soccer and stuff like this. And that is a fantastic thing to have, because I think you nearly need to speak that language to get some fellas who have either fallen out of contracts with maybe League of Ireland clubs or something like that, but who are on the periphery, to pull them back into Gaelic and to get them playing for Loud. Because I think that's an important thing, even from the underage, to come through, that there's a viable option for them. That it's not just all soccer, that you actually have a viable county team that you can go and, you know, still have that feeling of, you know, achievement and everything else. So he's doing a fantastic job. He really is doing a fantastic job. And it's great to see.
Yeah, absolutely. So they're up at the top of Division 3 at the moment on 6 points, level with Down. And then Terry Hyland, as we touched on there, joint first, with Derry in second place in scoring difference, both on 8 points at the top of Division 4. So we've got Graham, McEntee, Gallagher, Hyland and Kearns. And I'm sorry, we're going to have to push you forward there. Do we, like, leave Graham out of it just because on a results basis, he's not going as well as the other counties? Granted, it is Division 1. I think that's too easy to say.
Yeah. You know, I think it's too easy
to
say.
You have to be ruthless in some manner here.
You're being very ruthless early in the morning, Noel. I'd hate to see how you choose your breakfast. Okay, I'm going to say, I'd actually leave out Terry Hyland.
Terry Hyland, fair enough. So we've got Graham, McEntee, Gallagher and Kearns. We'll bring you the results of that Twitter poll a little bit later on. You can go on to @offtheball if you want to find us on Twitter. The other thing we wanted to just touch on at the top of the show here was about the Joe Schmidt factor in what's actually going on with Ireland at the moment. He seems mystified by what's going on in the camp, which is far more worrying than the idea that you and I are mystified by what's actually going on in the Ireland camp. And the question has been asked, and I'm sure has been on a lot of people's minds this morning, by David Kelly in the Irish Independent: has Joe Schmidt's early exit call caused players to slacken off? And it is a legitimate question, Anthony. Like, it has to have a little bit of a bearing. The way I see it, though, is kind of like you're still trying to impress this guy for what may be what some people have been calling as the biggest World Cup in Ireland rugby's history, because of the potential they have to go beyond the quarterfinals this time. And also you have his successor in the camp at the moment as well.
Correct. Yeah, so I listen, it's a question that needs to be asked, but I don't think there's any, you know, semblance of say evidence behind it. I don't, like, you take the results and listen, it's results based business, as they say. You look at the New Zealand game, you know, where they beat New Zealand. Really, if you analyse it, a week before, England really softened up New Zealand, okay? England lost by a point to them in a bruising game over there. So England or New Zealand came here fairly battered and bruised at the end of a season. Great win for Ireland, etc. But, like, I mean, everyone then was saying, oh, you know, world beaters, number two in the world, or whatever it was, pushing for number one. They are top of their game. And I think it's just been a little bit of the teams have really analysed them and kind of worked them out. Some players have gone off the boil. Some players like Sexton and Murray, people are talking about it a lot, have gone off the boil. Maybe there is a little bit of pressure. Maybe, as Rory O'Connor actually in the Independent was kind of saying, and Schmidt was even alluding to, you know, they were in the hole, and they seem to be just continuously trying to dig. As he was saying, well, they're going up to Belfast this weekend, and maybe they need to actually take a step back. Mm. I'd say they need to, you know, maybe just sit back, understand the achievements that they've made, understand the strides that they've made, take a bit of pressure off themselves. Now, that won't help them if they come out on Sunday week and France give them a beating here at home, which could very easily happen, by the way. You know, this thing of the French team, which one is going to turn up. But I was mightily impressed by them against Scotland last week. So I think you've got a situation for Schmidt. I don't really see it. If myself and yourself were in there, we're saying, well, Andy Farrell's next, so we're going to go absolutely hell for leather to make sure that our international careers stay on track. Mm. And also there's the prize of getting onto a World Cup team.
Yeah.
So I don't really get that. I think it's just a situation where maybe they were a bit Italy. You know, a few fellas made some uncharacteristic efforts. Yes, maybe. I think there was just a number of things that just all kind of joined together. Is the French game a big, big game as regards the result or as regards the performance? I think France will bring a devil-may-care attitude and really go at the structure of Ireland because they're very, very steadfast and very, very, you know, as I say, they're kind of nearly, it's rugby by numbers to a large degree. France, I would hope, are going to be, which you could see at the weekend, a bit more expansive, a bit more kind of, you know, just having a go. So I think it's going to be a really good chance for him to try to experiment. I suppose I'm a bit disappointed in the sense of the way he should have set really this Six Nations up, in my mind, would have said, and I think he tried to do it a small bit, but he really should have said, this is really an experimental basis for the World Cup. Mm. This is not about results. You know, I think he really should have laid the ground before it started.
Well, I don't think that was actually the case. I don't think Joe Schmidt was ever thinking this is an experimental basis. I think there was always the idea that it's going to be the second prize, or it's going to be the thing you're judged second most on when it comes to the year 2019. I think that's certainly true. But I think what the question about is Joe Schmidt's exit call affecting the players, I think that would suggest that there is a complacency within the camp. And when I look at the body language on Sunday, it doesn't suggest to me complacency. It suggests to me that they're getting angry quite easily, they're getting frustrated quite easily, which is kind of the opposite end of the spectrum a little bit. That the idea that, you know, and it's an easy thing for any coach to come out and say that the players are trying too hard because it takes the pressure off the coach.
Yeah.
Part of me actually does buy that. It does buy the idea that there is sort of an over-effort in areas here that it really just isn't coming naturally to them, and the errors are coming as a result of frustration and things like that as well.
Yeah.
Like maybe I'm being way too forgiving on that front, but it certainly seems that there is something in the idea that the players are trying too hard.
So are you trying to say that you think that the players are at fault or the coaches at fault?
Well, I think that the idea that Ireland's players have got complacent because their coach is leaving at the end of the World Cup, I just think that's, it may be a very, very tiny factor in it, but the reason why their performances have been subpar, especially on Sunday, doesn't suggest to me it's as a result of complacency.
Yeah, I don't, like, I mean, people will say there's complacency and people will say that, you know, body language, it's hard, and I know they're only human, right? But in a professional setup and the way Schmidt runs things, it is fairly methodical, okay? Mm. Everyone has a job. You're meant to just do your job. That's the idea. You know, you go, you do your job to the best of your ability. If you don't do your job, someone else will do your job. I think he is finding that as he starts to go through his top 15 players, that he has another 15 players who just can't do that job as well as the guy who was previously there. He alludes in one, I think, the Rory O'Connor piece about England, that if you remove 4 to 5 of England's best players, they just don't have the same players to come in. And he's right. Like, you take Farrell out of that team, you take Tuilagi, you take some of the Vunipolo, and so they don't really necessarily have the impact players who can take it on. The massive thing, I think, for Ireland and for all of the teams coming into the World Cup is all going to be about panel. And I think maybe he's doing a little bit of, oh, look over here, you know, this is going on. But at the same time, he's finding things out. I saw him saying, you know, we'll categorise it, we'll put it in our memory about, say, Delan. So Delan was maybe a thing he'd look and go, okay, he's an option now. He's a big option for the World Cup. Maybe I need to get a bit more time in there. And really, when you're trying to experiment and trying to get fellas to stand up, when is the time you really want to look at that as a coach? You don't want to look at a fella who's going to really stand out or who's going to stand up when you're flying it, when you're beating teams left, right and centre. You want to see them in the trenches. You want to see them in a situation like that. 16-12 behind at half time, you're in a situation, you go into the dressing room, you're saying, right, and you look around at the fellas and say, it's up to you to dig yourself out of this. Now, the fellas who put their hands up in that second half and do that, and Schmidt will analyse the living daylights out of that, they'll be the fellas that he will remove maybe from the bottom of his list up to the top of his list and go, OK, these are really viable players now for the World Cup. So, like, in those times of adversity, which I think the French match, what I really would love is France come absolutely hell for leather. They have to. They need more challenges like that, because he needs the answers. I saw him saying, you know, it's all back down to hard work. Yes, agree. But it's going to be down to their reaction as players. And that's why, I suppose, I think I take your point. Some of the reaction by some of the players wasn't good.
No.
You know, it wasn't good. And there's a little bit of the old throwing the toys out of the pram a little bit. You know, it's Sexton, say, for part of it. But other players' body languages is, say. But I think it's all about him and his management team finding out answers on players. And sometimes, be it a tight win or a loss, that's where you really find out about a guy and you say, actually, can I really rely on him? No.
Yeah, for sure. It's an interesting one. I'm sure it'll come up again as we go through the back pages. Let's tell you what's coming up first, though, on today's OTB AM. Gareth A. Davies is coming up pretty shortly to talk to us about the boxing picture, about Anthony Joshua fighting in America and the likes of that. Sports news coming your way with Darren Cleary at 8:35. We'll be touching on the League of Ireland with him at that point as well. Gaelic football then at around 8:50. Cathal O'Kane will join Anthony to pick through some of the big stories from the weekend, including GAA Congress and Six Nations 2019. More reaction to Ireland's narrow win over Italy on Sunday coming up after 9 o'clock. But we'll turn to the back pages now, and I will start with the Irish Independent. And it is a picture of what happened at Daly Mount last night. Bows sink 10-man Rovers, Dinny Delight at Daly Mount. It's Dinny Corcoran celebrating his winning goal as Bows beat Shamrock Rovers 1-0. They seem to have the Indian sign over them at the moment in the League of Ireland, so good news for everybody there. And Ireland a bit broken by England fallout is the main story on the back of the Independent this morning. Coach believes frustrated stars are trying too hard to get to the standards that they set in 2018, which is something I just touched on a bit a few moments ago. He says that the players were a bit broken by the fallout of the defeat to England, and says the coaching staff are trying to rebuild their confidence. Just to go through some of the quotes, he says, sometimes it's just about taking a step back. We always talk about going forward. Sometimes you've got to take a step back and take a deep breath and not panic, because I think the players were a bit broken by the fallout from the England game, and then suddenly they start to question themselves. I think the coaching staff, it's our job to re-energise the group and reignite the confidence. That ultimately, that is the other side of this thing, that you can say it's not complacency, but ultimately, if the players are reacting in a negative way at all, it is still up to the coaching staff to actually correct that.
Yeah, they need a good piss up this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. Is that what you would have done during times when the confidence was low?
Yeah. Get the pool table out, Frankie Dolan-esque.
it is a tricky one. Like, I'm sure, like, once the confidence is that sort of low, or there is sort of this mystique around why it's so low. Is it like sometimes there is much more ridiculous ideas than actually, you know, going on the piss for a couple of days or doing something to just distract yourself from the process of being a rugby player for a couple of days?
I didn't particularly like his comment, but then when I read it on, he can be misquoted where you say, you know, it's about us all getting back to just hard work. I wouldn't necessarily like that, because I think if you went into that panel and said, right, lads, we're going to double down on the effort, it'd be like, oh, you know, come on.
Yeah,
because they're all giving it. You can just imagine the intensity and the pressure that's in there at the moment in that camp. You know, you go from here thinking great, and next thing you're down and everyone's questioning you. So I think maybe just a blow off of steam is probably required.
Yeah, maybe happening as we speak right now. Who are we to know?
Exactly.
Back page of the Herald this morning, Leeds with that big result in the League of Ireland Premier Division last night. Bohemian Rhapsody is the headline. Bows go top as Corcoran penalty downs 10-man Rovers in Derby. I was away at the weekend, so I haven't actually been able to follow Bows this weekend. I did go to their first game of the season, and it's a great old atmosphere there at Daly Mount. And unfortunately, I'm not sure if I've been kicked off the bandwagon because I missed the big one last night. But they beat Rovers 1-0. And Robertson looks for spark to light Reds. This is actually not too dissimilar to the tone in the Liverpool camp at the moment. Isn't too dissimilar to the tone in the Ireland camp Andy Robertson there talking about the idea of just trying to find that little something that Liverpool had at the start of the season in terms of trying to get this Premier League title race back on track. The back page of the Racing Post this morning is Slog on the Tyne. Newcastle primed to stop confident Clarets. It's an 8 p.m. kickoff tonight in the Premier League between Newcastle and Burnley. There's four fixtures in all. The Irish Examiner then leads with Kelly Harrington. Without sport, I don't know where I would be. And you've also got Tracy Kennedy there, the Cork chair person, saying the only decision is for the Parkie Quay pitch to be replaced. And Mike Quirk as well, writing about Cork as well this morning. The Irish Times then leads with these Joe Schmidt quotes as well. Gerry Thornley's piece says, Schmidt admits to being worried about performances, and then his own column is saying, Ireland's green machine running on dirty diesel. And Contepomi understands fiery Sexton's frustrations. So Leinster backs coach believes Ireland can learn from dips and become stronger. It seems that Felipe Contepomi sees a little bit of himself in Johnny Sexton at the moment and his body language. And the Times Ireland edition, going with this as well, Schmidt says, not time to panic over our form. You've also got that red card for Aaron Green there. It's the main picture on the back of the Times this morning as Rovers were reduced to 10 men, which seemed pivotal in the end. And the Irish Daily Mail goes with Blues at war. Divisions over Kepa turns heat on Sarri. It's all happening at Chelsea at the moment. It seems like Maurizio Sarri is going to survive a little bit longer. And you've got a few interesting quotes around the whole saga. Jose Mourinho, believe it or not, has backed Kepa in this whole incident.
Oh, yes.
Like, it's...
Yeah, well, funny you say that, because he is literally all over the old the tabloids. Sarri reads Kepa riot act is in the Sun, and in the Irish Daily Star, you've got gloves are off, Chelsea players fuming at Kepa over humiliation of boss. And then it's saying that there's speculation that Brendan Rodgers might be on the Blues radar, which I'd find, I don't know. But of course, there he is, Jose, in the mirror. Mourinho's verdict on Chelsea crisis. Nothing like a man to walk in when everyone else is. Just to remind you, my old club's a sorry mess. Jose praises Kepa for showing personality.
For God's sake. Like,
personality. Imagine, how do you think Jose would have dealt with that?
Oh, like Jose would have tried his best to kick Kepa out of the club, would have failed because of the player power and culture that exists at Chelsea Football Club, and then Jose would have got kicked out of the club, and you basically repeat that immediately. Like, you talk about...
I'd say he actually possibly would have ran onto the pitch, dragged him off.
He probably would have. Well, he ran onto the pitch close enough to pull a physio or a doctor off the pitch previously, so I presume he'd do it for a football player. Like, we talk about, players getting complacent if a manager is set to leave. If you're a Chelsea football player and say you've just signed a 3-year contract, you know to yourself, I'm going to outlast the manager here.
Yeah.
And if complacency can set in when, in perhaps the Ireland rugby squad at the moment, if there's ever a possibility of that happening, then there's definitely a possibility of complacency just being an occupational hazard at Chelsea Football Club.
Absolutely. Yeah. Continuous. Yeah.
It really is.
It's there in your locker, just ready to come out any time you need it.
It's an absolute banker of a trend at the moment. Yeah. And some players can live with that. They can see it as a short-term thing. But really, it has to seep into the subconscious at some point, which I think it has done with what we saw on Sunday afternoon.
It is. It's amazing. And of course, just right on time as well, the Daily Telegraph has a lovely interview with Jose.
Look at that picture.
I want to be happy in my next job. And if that's Chelsea, by the way, I will be happy. Like, it's just perfect timing. It's literally like, yeah, I think I'll do an interview with you this week.
It's just kind of like, it's not enough of a smile to look fake. It looks like an earnest smile.
Yeah.
Looking down the barrel of the lens. It's like a LinkedIn profiler.
Yeah. And of course, up on top, stay of execution, Sarri hangs on to Chelsea job for now.
Yeah.
Could we get any more, kind of suggestive on the one page? I have to say, it was absolutely, whatever about Sarri, that, his reaction on the weekend was just unbelievable. Like, it was unbelievable to see.
Have you ever seen it in any walk of life?
I've seen fellas come off and be annoyed and be really annoyed and do various different things, but I've never seen a situation like that.
No.
The rule is that he actually doesn't have to come off. Isn't that true?
Clearly, he obviously has
read the rule book.
He knew his rights as a Chelsea player, which is, not respect your manager whatsoever.
Yeah.
It almost seems like a necessary thing. We've got a couple of the UK back pages this morning as well. It's a compliment, says Anthony Joshua. He laughed off Gerald Miller's accusation of doping. Liverpool must start respecting themselves, says Mark Critchley's report. That Sandy Robertson speaking as well. And David Luiz saying, we showed Sarri support. Now, this may come from the fact that I do wonder how much the Chelsea players actually respect Kepa. It would be different if it was Eden Hazard or somebody whose performances all season have been magnificent. Like, magnificent is maybe a strong word to describe Hazard's season, because when he's been good, he's been great, but sometimes you can accuse him of dropping his head. But the point is that, do the Chelsea players really think that Kepa's been worth the money he's been signed for? Like, he's in something like the top five most expensive English signings of all time. Has he lived up to that price tag? I would say a lot of his teammates would suggest no. So I think that's more kind of a lack of support for Kepa than a support for Sarri.
Yeah.
We've also got the UK Mail here Blues at War, same headline there. And Leeds may be sold if they fail to win promotion. So pretty big stakes there if they fail to go up this year. The Mirror goes with my old club's a sorry mess. That's Jose praising Kepa for showing personality. And the Star, the UK Star, goes with Kepa, me in a job. Sorry puts future in hands of rebel goalie. And Sarri reads Kepa riot act, says the back of the Sun this morning. And the Times, as we've already said, Sarri will not drop Kepa. Six Nations in talks with equity firm. And I think that's it from the UK back pages this morning. We've got AIS as well this morning to show you. And it is Plan Anti-Vinicius. So you can probably guess from that, even though it's not in our language, that there's going to be a plan without Vinicius there, looking into El Clasico and the second leg of that one. It's on tomorrow night. So that's Valverde considering Sergio Roberto or Semedo to cover his runs. All eyes clearly focus on tomorrow's sold-out Copa Clásico. That's the translation of that on the back page. Just a couple of comments on the GAA manager of the year so far. It has to be Andy McEntee, says deck done. Kieran Cunningham says no Peter Keane to annoy the Kerry man. I'm not, no comment at the moment from Anthony Moyles' reluctance to include Peter Keane.
Staying in the long grass, Owen.
Can't believe that Owen Sheehan didn't get Peter Keane pushed through on the list. Again, Jonathan Higgins commenting there, no point in arguing over this one. A journalist once asked Mickey Graham what's it like to be manager of the year so far, or this year so far. He replied, I don't know, you'd have to ask Rory Gallagher, says David Kelly. Stuart Regan says, where is Terry Highland? Hashtag Leitrim Rising. Terry Highland ruthlessly getting caught by Anthony Moyles. We'll get Terry Highland and Peter Keane on together some morning to give out about Anthony Moyles. Deco B says, Moylesy is Mead manager, club manager of the year so far anyway. Unbeaten in the league and introduced a whole pile of young lads. Hashtag Mahon Farrar, says Deco B. Care to comment?
No.
Well, this is a pretty big compliment.
It's only the league.
Only the league. What's going on at the moment? What have your results been like?
Not bad. Two draws and two wins.
We're talking so, Dunshaughlin, of course.
Yes.
I've just been told about Dunshaughlin's corner forwards, two very promising kids that you've given game time to, and the pitch time has reaped rewards.
Yeah, kids. Yeah, it's very young. Actually, I have to say the standard and I think it's starting to show true with the senior team. The standard is absolute. There's been a serious amount of work put in over the last 5 or 6 years. So a lot of 17, 18, 19-year-olds really coming good. Big men, well able to play. So, you know, we've two lads, Luke Mitchell and Matthew Costello, who were on the Mead minor team last year. Matthew was the captain and Luke was corner forward, and they're good lads. You know, they're in with the Mead under 20s with Barry Callahan. But there's plenty of other fellas. You know, there's really, really good kind of stock coming through in Shocklin. And as I say, you know, all through, we've played numerous teams. We played Oldcastle, we played Dunmore Ashburn. We've played Screen, and at the weekend we played Mynalvi, and there's just a good cohort of younger lads coming through the Mead setup, and it's great to see Andy obviously given opportunities. Like there's a young lad, Dara Campion from Screen, who's playing on the senior team, and he's doing really, really well. So it's things are boding well. Like, I mean, he's got a very, very solid back line now, and he's mixing in some really good, a lot of pace, you know, but also pace with size. There was, I suppose, over the last number of years, there was a lot of pace, but they were extremely small players. No, I don't mean that in a bad way, but, you know, when you're coming up against the physicality of, say, James McCarthy or, you know, Philly McMahon, etc., it was just getting blown away a bit, whereas these lads are actually big lads, you know, they're well able to handle it, and there's obviously been a lot of work put into them, and it's starting to reap the rewards.
Is that a trend at the moment that county teams are judging players on physicality as much as anything else, that they don't really have the patience? Not really the patience, but you kind of need to be big and ready to go from an early age. There's no time to wait for you to actually build up your man strength, so to speak.
You have to be. I think you have to be. And I think, you know, we commented about this a couple of weeks ago about the Kerry team. You know, there's a massive difference in size and physicality, say, in someone like, you know, Shamie O'Shea from last year, right, to this year. Like, I mean, you can just see it. Again, actually, I was just looking at the
Shamie O'Shea, obviously.
Shamie O'Shea, sorry. I was looking at the Cavan game at the weekend, and even the Roscommon game, there's a lot of... There's just size everywhere. There's big units, you know, going around, big legs. You know, you can see there's an awful lot of S&C being done in the right areas. Before, it was all kind of very much top heavy, you know, like it being. But whereas now there's a lot of focus, obviously, on, and obviously the resilience to keep going through training sessions and the load that's being put on players. But I think you're right. You have to be... The one big thing that happens to a lot of 18, 19, 20-year-olds who break into senior teams is they just can't actually put up with the workload. So they end up tearing hamstrings, groins, whatever it is, because they go from a situation where they might be training twice or three times with a club to training six times. And it's just like, whoa, you know, it's a shock to the system. So you need to prep that. So you're prepping that from 16, 17, 18. You're getting them used to it. So when they hit the senior setup, it's like, you know, yeah, I'm well used to this. You know.
I'm sure there's plenty of people watching as well this morning who are looking for your take on what happened at Congress at the weekend. We will get to that a little bit later on. We're going to turn to boxing next, but before that, just to tell you about our competition. So as Ireland prepare for their penultimate Guinness Six Nations clash against France at the Aviva Stadium, official partner Dove Men Plus Care is giving you the chance to be part of the captain's run. The winner will join the IRFU kitman John Moran as he prepares the dressing room for the Irish rugby team ahead of their final training session before the big game. And if that isn't enough, the winner will also receive a pair of tickets to see Ireland against France at the Aviva the following day. To be in with a chance to win, just tell us what your favourite rugby jersey is. Tweet us or comment where you're watching the show and make sure you use the hashtag TeamCare and OTBAM so that we know you've entered. So as I say, we're going to be talking boxing and Bellator next with Gareth Davies, who's live on the line from San Francisco. But before that, James, the Strabanimal Gallagher, got back to winning ways at the Three Arena on Saturday night at Bellator Dublin. Here he is reacting to that victory and speaking to Niall McGrath.
It feels great. So it does. It feels absolute. That humbles me. Walking out there, everyone stood me when I got beat. You need to be humble. That there will make you humble. That won't. That won't humble me. When I go out there in front of my home country and see them people get behind me like that, and I get to go out there and hear them, that support, that love that they give me, that humbles me. I'm fucking so grateful, so I'm absolutely blown away.
James, we spoke about the haters during the week. Does it ever become a point where it actually gets unsettling for you?
Never, mate. Never. I don't focus on negativity. I focus on the positive people that are around me who want to see me climb up. That's all I focus on. When people in my local football team, when they win, I'm like, yes! Do you know what I mean? It's not, no one knows about it. But when I hear about the small success, but people be like, it's just small. Not to me. Success is success. There's no levels to it. Success is success. And I thrive off success, and I just love to see people succeed. And that's what I'm about. That's what I focus on. When they're hating on me, I'm too busy looking at the success to give a shit what they're saying. It's not going to... That doesn't mean jack shit. Fuck them. Hate me. Hit me all you like. You're wasting your energy while I'm putting my energy into success.
You talk about humble there. Obviously, you lost the last fight. And, you know, I often see, and we often see it as mixed martial artists, that lose a fight, you know, they come back tenfold better and they learn so much about themselves. Is that how you feel?
Yeah.
You even feel that humbleness?
100%. So it is. I learned so many different things about myself as a person. I took a good look at myself in the mirror. You're getting stood on. The hardest thing in life is being truthful to yourself. I can say what I want here, do you know what I mean? And yous might believe me, yous might not. But the hardest thing in the world to do is be truthful with yourself. I went back, was truthful with myself in the mirror, told myself what I had to do, and I went and done it.
Yeah, James Gallagher there speaking after the Bellator card in Dublin on Saturday night. Gareth Davies, I'm delighted to say, joins us now on the line. Good morning to you, Gareth.
Morning, Owen. Morning, Anthony. How are you, gents?
Very well, thanks. We may as well start asking you by James Gallagher there. Where is the ceiling for this guy? Like, people who haven't followed his career, he's obviously come back from a defeat. He says he's humbled by the crowd and all that sort of thing. He's clearly trying to carve out a niche for himself. What do you think of James Gallagher?
Well, I think it would be brilliant if he was sponsored by expletives.com because he'd probably make quite a lot of money, wouldn't he, to start with. But no, he's a great guy. And I have interviewed people where they're putting the bloody arena away and you can hear every crash, bang and wallop there as they're stacking the seats. And it's very irritating. You turn the TV on or turn the camera on and suddenly they're stacking seats. He's a very, very talented fighter and athlete, with a very interesting background, obviously from Strabane, and, you know, with a very tapestried history there that has been told before and is a brilliant fighter. And I think the most impressive thing about him, Owen, in the last 6 months was coming back from knee surgery and getting banjoed, really, and beaten up by a guy called Ricky Bandejas in the United States on his comeback, moving down to bantamweight from featherweight. And, you know, as he was talking about there, he took a lot of flack for it because he's very, you know, he winds people up, James. He's there. He's there to be the winner. He's there. He's got an arrogance about him, you know, and there's an aping in some ways of what Conor McGregor was and produced. But he's got real skills and he's in with the right people at the right time at the moment because Bellator have just signed a deal with Sky Sports. That event on Saturday night was broadcast on Sky Sports, the second event to do so. Only the second mixed martial arts event ever of that caliber on Sky Sports, gents, in prime time. Channel 5 have got a deal with Bellator now, and they're owned by Viacom in the United States. They've got a DAZN deal. So he's very young. He's clearly influenced by what Conor McGregor achieved and acts like him in a way, but he's got genuine talent. The ceiling, it's in a really good bantamweight division. I think he was in a tougher featherweight division, and I think it was a wise move to move down. I do think he'll win a world title, but even more than that, he's got a following. And as you know, Anthony, when you don't, if someone loves the style that you play a sport in, if you give everything when you go and do it, and you've got an X factor and a crowd follow, you don't necessarily need to be the world champion because there's a following there that want to be around you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's sort of like it kind of creates a cult following if it's not kind of backed up with a level of success either. But like, I guess from the way you're talking there, Gareth, there kind of is a chance here of a huge level of success. And like, I know you were in studio with us about a year and a half ago when Bellator was in Dublin at the time as well. And kind of there was a sense that this thing was growing. Like, it's obviously grown quite a distance since then to the point where it's live in Sky Sports. Like, is there a chance now that we stop talking about Bellator fighters as potential UFC fighters and we start to appreciate this thing for what it is?
Absolutely. We're talking about two rival promotions now, and it's very different to boxing, of course, where sometimes rival promoters and rival TV companies will come together for the very biggest fights. We won't see that with the UFC and Bellator because they are essentially fight leagues. You know, like the NFL is an NFL league. MLB is a league. And that's how it's done in America. But no, they've easily. If the UFC had got the Channel 5 and the Sky Sports deal that Bellator have just got, no other mixed martial arts organization would ever have got anywhere near them in Europe and this region, Europe, Ireland, England, and over to Eastern Europe where it's popular as well, would never got anywhere near. This is the big hike up for Bellator. It's not predicated on a pay-per-view model as the UFC is, where William Morris Endeavor, the new owners, bought it for $4.5 billion. I'm sure Anthony's across this as well. Bought it for $4.5 billion 3 years ago, and they got a massive mortgage to pay. So everything they do, the UFC, is predicated on pay-per-view. They create a star, and they will be burning that star up as quickly as possible in the biggest possible fights. There's more of a slower build, a kind of more organic build, if you like, with Bellator, and I think it's very sensible, and I think they're putting roots in everywhere. And I think that, like you say, I was in a year and a half ago, I think Hoist Gracie was choking me out in the studio, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Put me to sleep. That was great. they're doing a great thing by building organically, and I think they will get there. They've got the things in place now. The sponsors are coming, that the fighters are allowed their own sponsors, which they're not allowed in the UFC. So I think, no, we're talking about UFC fighters coming to Bellator now, believe it or not, more than Bellator fighters going to UFC.
Is there enough of a pool, Gareth, you think, to have both of them, vying for the talent? Is that why they're jumping on the likes of this guy to try to, kind of push the next big thing?
Well, I mean, look, in Ireland, The tsunami of support for mixed martial arts with the growth of Conor McGregor and Straight Blast Gym and, was enormous. I mean, the Irish, let's just celebrate it, Wales beating England for a moment. There we go. Celebrated it. What a test match. When it comes to supporting rugby, Gaelic football, their own boxers, martial artists, mixed martial artists. You don't get better fans than the Irish. And they turned out at the Three Arena last Saturday night and sold it out again. It wasn't the biggest card in the world, but there were some great fights. Peter Queeley and Miles Price had venom about it because Price had trained in Khabib Nurmagomedov's gym in San Jose ahead of Conor McGregor fighting Khabib. So there was a bit of steam there. But no, I think there is scope. But we don't know how big this sport's going to be. I mean, I've been covering it 12 to 14 years now, and it's grown enormously in that time, Anthony. I think there is scope for two promotions everywhere, two, and maybe one in Asia, one championship's very big. I think TV companies, as we've seen in America, DAZN have put $140 million into 21 Bellator events over 3 years. You know, there's a lot of money swirling around for live, visceral, kind of dramatic, theatrical sport, and fight sports has that, you know. And as long as you've got the characters within it, it's going to be a success. I always remember this. It's what I always say to people when they say, you know, as I was talking about just now about someone not necessarily needing to be the champion, Billy Walker, a British heavyweight in the 60s, never won a world title, never won a European title, but he sold out Wembley Arena 9 times, I think it was, and made a fortune. And his brother opened fast food joints. But it was because he had a flick of blonde hair. He was up and down in his fights, and he delivered every time. And people loved seeing him fight. And that's all you need. Do you know what I mean? You just need people who are inspiring and people who want to be followed, you know?
Yeah, well, it's going to be a very interesting couple of months in the years for sure when it comes to Bellator. We did want to talk to you as well, Gareth, about boxing, because we've been meaning to chat to you over the last couple of weeks since Anthony Joshua's latest fight was announced against Jarrell Big Baby Miller. And of course, when we talk about heavyweight boxing, I think 2018 was as good as a year as I can remember over the last while for heavyweight boxing. It ended in unbelievable fashion with what happened in the Wilder Fury fight. Given what's happened so far this year, given that Joshua's now fought Miller, we suspected there might be perhaps a bigger fight on the cards for him. Are you a tad concerned at all about the heavyweight picture about 2019 in terms of actually making those big fights happen?
Well, I think, Owen, you know, what you point to there is last Monday, when we were expecting Tyson Fury and Deontay Wilder's date and venue to be announced in America as sometime in May in Vegas or New York, as you say, after that brilliant fight last December, it was announced that he signed a deal with Bob Arum and ESPN in the United States. And what that does, it just moves that fight further away, probably by one or two fights. DAZN are determined to get Anthony Joshua in there with Wilder or Fury, I think, by May, June 2020. And I think we'll probably see that at Wembley next year if things play out. If Joshua isn't beaten by Miller, I don't expect him to be beaten by Miller at Madison Square Garden on June the 1st, but he'll have another fight then. Tyson Fury and Deontay Wilder will have an interim fight before they probably fight in September. There's rows at the moment. There's a very interesting Twitter spat yesterday between Eddie Hearn and Steven Espinoza, the head of Showtime Sports, in which they were accusing each other, both accusing each other of lying about contractual issues between Wilder and Joshua, and that all that shenanigans was going on over 5 or 6 months. There's so much money on the table for these three men in particular, Joshua, Wilder and Fury, to fight each other, that those fights will definitely happen. The problem is how it will be longed out, how it will be stretched out. You know, the ultimate fight really is Tyson Fury against Anthony Joshua at Wembley Stadium next May. I mean, could you imagine how big that would be, you know? Every traveller in the world's going to be there. Every Joshua fan listen, 8,000, 9,000 travellers went to LA for Joshua's fight with Wilder, and they were awesome. Travellers get a bad name sometimes, but I've got to say, the travellers that are around Tyson Fury are impeccably well-behaved, and they were out there. They misbehaved in Manchester, a few of them, last year, but they were brilliant. And, you know, Tyson Fury's become a bit of a cult hero. God, he was the Irish champion at one point, wasn't he? Yeah. He's become a real cult figure. They really are polar opposites in many ways. You know, Anthony Joshua is very much the corporate guy of the sports world, the boxing world. Less is more with him. I'm banging on here, but I am so enthusiastic about this heavyweight division. It's a brilliant time for the heavyweight division, and this Game of Thrones will eventually have to play out. But just to cut my very long story into a headline, the ESPN and Bob Arum deal in the States with Fury does extend the length of time that it'll take for all these three to fight each other.
If you were running a US network right now, who would you rather have as your kind of blue ribbon fighter? Would it be Tyson Fury, or would it be Anthony Joshua Garrett? Who do you think
That's
is more likely
question.
To penetrate the US?
I'd like to have Anthony Fury. No, it's very difficult. I mean, Joshua has the personality, the looks, the charisma. Some people say he's wooden. I don't think he is, but he's got the charisma and looks in a certain way to absolutely steam and steal the American market, you know.
Is he known much over there, Gareth?
No, he isn't. That is the one thing, Anthony. I think Tyson Fury with his Undertaker feet in the 12th round of, you know, and the way I've been coming over here for over 20 years covering fights, and the American media reckon, people I've spoken to say he is the best person for quotes. They enjoyed Ricky Hatton, to be fair, and Nazim Hamid, but he's the best, most charismatic figure in terms of quotes they get off him and time available and how he is with people that they've had. He really did capture the American market last year, Fury. They took the gamble. They didn't know how he was going to perform against Wilder after all that time away. He, remember, he shed the same amount of weight as Melania Trump, for God's sake. Do you know what I mean? To get into shape. So, you know, he pulled off the unthinkable. And I think that's why they've elevated him into this bargaining position. If I was in America right now, yeah, I'm going to say Fury. I'll get lambasted for that by all the Joshua fans, but I'm going to say Fury.
Right. Question for you, Garrett. So has Wilder lost a little bit of his sheen because of that fight with Fury? And do you think he was a little bit taken aback, a little bit shocked by it? Because, you know, I noticed after it. Like, I don't think he thought it was going to be the battle that it was. And, you know, Fury's resilience, I think, maybe shocked him. I don't know. What do you think, and what's the feeling over there?
No, I think you're spot on. You know your sport, Anthony. You know people's body language. Deontay Wilder's body language afterwards was of a man who looked like he was relieved that he got the draw, frankly. Yes, he knocked Fury down twice, but he knew he was completely outboxed. And as such, this was a man, I say, Fury coming back, two facile warm-up fights, 30 months away, fighting depression, obesity, all, you know, a ban, all those things. And he schooled Wilder in boxing terms. And what it did was it took the shine, as you say, off Wilder's record of knocking out 39 of his 40 opponents. All his opponents he'd knocked out, but he fought Stiverne twice. But he'd knocked out everybody he'd fought. And yet Tyson Fury made him look like a wild brawler in there. You know, with a big left hand and a big right hand and not a lot of footwork. So in many ways, you know, people have elevated Fury. Bob Arum reckons that Fury is the generational character in the heavyweight division. Anthony Joshua is still to be tested properly. Listen, Wilder and Joshua will still be an amazing fight. Fury and Joshua will be a very similar kind of like, can Joshua land on the guy who's impossible to hit or difficult to hit? So yes, Wilder's stock, even though he's the WBC champion, is probably at the third. He's probably third in line of the three of those guys at the moment, I would say, in most people's eyes.
Yeah, well, it is, as you say, a fascinating Game of Thrones that's going on there at the moment. One last thing we wanted to touch on, Garrett, before we let you go, is Amir Khan, because you're interviewing him this week. And I guess you never would have suspected at the start of the year that it might be a big year for Amir Khan. But come April, it's probably, I think, his biggest fight in 3 years when he comes up against Terence Crawford. Like, if he gets a win there, Gareth, you're suddenly talking about Amir Khan coming back to being a household name. What's your view of him and the British view of him at the moment?
Well, every sports lover loves a comeback story. Every sports fan loves the giant killing. It's sometimes, I mean, you don't like it when your team's been slain by David and you're Goliath, but this is a really tough fight for Amir Khan. But, you know, as we saw at the weekend, people were wondering whether there was... I was at Chris Eubank, James DeGale, and people were wondering whether James De Gale had one more big performance in him. He didn't, as it happened, and I didn't think he did anyway. And I thought Chris Eubank Jr. Would dominate him, and he did dominate him. Amir Khan's got an opportunity. He spent 3 or 4 years pursuing a fight with Floyd Mayweather that came very close, with Manny Pacquiao that came very close. And let's remember, at the time, Amir Khan had the fastest hand speed in boxing. And he's got the spirit of a warrior. The problem is he's careless. He'll get soaking wet in that shower. He doesn't kind of step in and out. He just wants to get straight in. Terence Crawford is arguably in the top 3 pound for pound in the world. So this is that moment where he gets that Pacquiao or that Mayweather figure. I can't wait to see him perform. I came to see him a few weeks ago as well, because my girlfriend lives here as well, so I get to stay here and go and see Amir a lot. And he's back with Virgil Hunter, which I think is good. Amir's very mature now. He's one of the oldest guys in the gym, that Andre Ward used to train in. It's in Haywood, just down the road here. And I really hope he goes well against Terence Crawford. And Crawford respects him as a boxer and a fighter, and they get involved in a very complex game of chess. But my instinct is that Crawford's going to knock him out in 6 or 7 rounds. Crawford's very clever, switches brilliantly off both feet, very heavy-handed, and he's got an incredible IQ. I think Amir might be ahead after 2 or 3 rounds. I hope I'm wrong, but I just think this is probably the last stand for Amir Khan at Madison Square Garden on April the 20th.
All right, well, we look forward to the interview, Gareth. Best of luck with it, and chat to you soon.
Pleasure, gents. Thanks very much.
Cheers. We'll finish on this in terms of combat sports. Here is MMA fighter Paul Redmond after his Bellator 217 win, showing exactly what that fight meant to him.
How are your emotions, Paul? You just said to me there a second ago, you look very emotional here.
It's tough. People don't understand. You put your life, and I mean, my life point is coming off after last year. I was done. And Andy made me, we've had a chat,
So,
just emotional.
The second time Andy Ryan has had this chat with you now, how much does he mean to you in your career? Thinking about him now with those tears in your eyes, him talking to you out of it?
Everything.
Sorry, Dad.
No, it's no problem.
Yeah, Paul Redmond there speaking after his fight at the Three Arena on Saturday night. So Bohemians, as you mentioned at the top of the show, took the spoils from the first Dublin derby of the season last night, beating Rovers 1-0. The respective managers Keith Long and Stephen Bradley spoke to Jamie Moore after the game.
So with the Bohemians manager Keith Long, Keith, you've just won the derby. Your man, Mr. Dinny Corcoran, 3 goals in 3 games. And you've beaten Rovers, I think, 5 in the last 6 occasions. So great night here at Dalymount again.
Yeah, it's we're delighted to win the game. Very, very big game for us as a club, beating our fiercest rivals, Shamrock Rovers. So, first game of the season in the derby, and we've won the 3 games. We're top of the table, 9 points, fantastic.
With the Shamrock Rovers head coach Stephen Bradley, Stephen, your thoughts on the Dublin derby tonight, the first of the season?
I thought we were fully in control of the game until the sending off. Felt it was a terrible decision to send them off. We're standing right in front of it. I thought we played really well in large patches.
Have you seen the red card back on video, or did you need to see it?
Yeah, no, I've seen it back. It's never sent enough. It's not even a book, and Aaron actually doesn't touch him.
Why do you think the red was given?
The ref was given a yellow, and the fourth official was the one that said red card. So,
yeah, I've just seen it myself on a phone and on one of the RT cameras, and I think it's a foul, but I don't think it's a red card. And the fact it's right in front of the Bowes dugout and the fourth official is there, does that add to the possibility? I'm sure if it was in front of your bench, you might have been up if it was a Bowes player.
Yeah, but it's still not. It doesn't matter what side it makes the tackle. It's still not a red card. It's a yellow card. Get on with the game.
Well, it was in front of us. I thought Aaron went over the ball. Thought he was a little bit high. Referee seemed to concur. The fourth official was there. That's what it looked like. From where I was, I think the referee gets the decision correct.
Well, up until the sending off, we were excellent. We moved them about. We were the only team playing. We looked really good. Sending off shook us for a few minutes, and then we settled again. We took Jack off at half time and went with Dan up, and again I thought in patches we are good, and they created a lot of chances at the end.
Well, they're great games to be involved in. Obviously the supporters don't need to get motivated for them, because both sets of supporters, it's really important to them. So we're just pleased to send our supporters home happy tonight. We've done that tonight, which is fantastic. Last year's record against Rovers, I know people are talking about it, but it's irrelevant. It doesn't really matter, because last season, you know, is gone. So we're talking about tonight, we're talking about getting a good win over Rovers. I thought we deserved to win. Yes, it does help if, you know, the opposition goes out to 10 men. Of course, it has a bearing on the game. But I still felt with 11-11 on the park that we would still create openings. And, you know, I'm glad to say we kept a clean sheet. We had some good, solid performances from our goalkeeper out. And I think we deserve to win.
So I think that's six games now you haven't beaten Bowes, five wins for them and a draw. That's tough considering your fans are like 900 behind that goal here to support you. It's a tough run you're on against them.
Yeah, the fans are brilliant, but it's hard. It's hard when the referee makes a decision like that after 20 odd minutes in a game like that. It's a ridiculous decision, and it kills the game.
How are the players now giving you to start the season so well with two good wins and you were coming here against Bowes in a top of the table clash, albeit it was only early in the season?
Players are fine. Yeah. Players are fine, we look really fit, really strong. Like I said, we played some really good stuff at times, created a lot of chances. Players are fine.
Does it hurt anymore given it's Bowes that you've lost it?
Yeah, it hurts when we lose a game, and obviously a derby, of course it hurts, but we'll regroup and we go again Friday.
Yeah, Stephen Bradley there, clearly disappointed with a referee's decision for the red card there in the wake of last night's 1-0 draw, or 1-0 loss, defeat, I should say, to Bowes last night in the League of Ireland Premier Division. Speaking to Jamie Moore last night, Darren Cleary's with us in studio. Very good morning to you, Darren.
Good morning, Owen. Yeah, I was surprised to hear Bradley say it wasn't a red. Any reports I read yesterday, Johnny Ward did one for the RT website, seemed to suggest that it was a rash enough tackle and a red card was not a surprising outcome for him and some of the other match reports I read. So Bradley came out very, very strongly against it there, which is one of the beauties of the League of Ireland. They don't seem to have too much of a problem with criticising referees or openly calling those contentious calls and kind of rubbing a bit of doubt into them.
So on a scale of probably between 90% and 100%, how sure are you that Bowes are going to win the league?
I don't know. I was pretty sure Bowes would win last night.
They do have a great record.
They have a very, very good record. That's 5 out of 6 and one draw in going back since 2017. So I think Jamie Moore every week will tweet the fixtures and there's a couple of people he tags and you have to do your predictions of who you think will win. I got 4 out of 5 yesterday. I don't mean to...
Oh, nice work.
Blow my own trumpet.
Absolutely.
4 out of 5 isn't bad. Yeah, if I was a betting man now, I might have won some money, but not for me.
I clearly picked the wrong weekend to leave the country because my beloved Bowes obviously just had a great couple of days. Also, Friday night against UCD.
Yeah.
If you want to just brag here for a little while, Danny Mandrew, who I spotted the previous week and said he's a good player, scored the winner in that game. So it's a good week all round for the predictions, I think.
It's a great start for them as well because it was a tough start. They played two teams that expect to be thereabouts in the table, Finn Harps and UCD. So it was always a rough enough start to the season. And then Rovers coming, they've recruited well in the off-season. No matter how good Bowes' record is against Rovers, they're a pretty formidable side. So that's a huge start to the season for Bowes. Really, really impressive to pick up 9 points out of 9.
You may have it in your bulletin because there is a breaking news story in terms of football cross-channel at the moment. Nothing completely concrete yet, I must stress, but reports in numerous places, namely John Percy in the Daily Telegraph, saying that talks are progressing now between Leicester City and Celtic over a move to appoint Brendan Rodgers as manager now. Official approach was made on Monday. The Herald in Scotland have also gone with the story, but again, nothing more concrete than Celtic sources. Breaking news, they're saying that Celtic manager Brendan Rodgers has left the club to succeed Claude Puel at Leicester City. We will be back on to you if we hear anything more concrete on that, but two fairly good sources in the Herald in Scotland and the Telegraph in England reporting that Brendan Rodgers is set to become the new Leicester City manager.
Yeah, the Evening Times as well in Scotland have the story that he has left Celtic. The club have yet to tweet anything about it. They've yet to release anything, so we will keep you updated on that. If it is true, it will be very, very quickly they will move to get that information out there, since that's already in the public domain. Meanwhile, to last night's League of Ireland action, and St. Pat's remain unbeaten, but they failed to find the net in a 0-0 draw with Finn Harps at Richmond Park. Cork City got a much needed 3 points after losing their opening two matches. Last season's runners-up edged Sligo Rovers 2-1. Goals from Sean McLaughlin and Gerard Morrissey key to the victory at the showgrounds. Dundalk finally picked up their first win of the season. Pat Hooban and Michael Duffy found the net for the Lilywhites. They came from 1-0 down to beat UCD 2-1. That follows two successive draws in their first two matches. Derry City defeated Waterford by 3-2 at the Ryan McBride Brandywell. It was an unfortunate night for Waterford, who coughed up 2 own goals in the game. Now, the Chelsea goalkeeper Kepa Arrizabalaga has been fined a week's wages for disrespecting manager Mauricio Sarri. The Spaniard has apologised for refusing to be substituted in the League Cup final. He's been fined €225,000 for his actions, with that money going to Chelsea's charitable foundation. Sarri himself said he didn't punish the player and left it up to the club to decide what discipline, if any, they would put on him. Sarri says the keeper made a big mistake in the way he reacted, but he now considers the matter to be closed. Meanwhile, Michael Owen has hit back at Manchester United fans after they criticised him for comments made during the Liverpool game. The striker, who has played for both clubs, suggested Liverpool's players should deliberately injure Marcus Rashford during their clash at Old Trafford last Sunday. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was forced into making three substitutions in the first half. Ander Herrera, Juan Mata and Jesse Lingard all suffered injuries. Owen said this at half-time: "If I was Jurgen Klopp in that dressing room at half-time with Manchester United not being able to bring on another sub, I'd be saying, right, first person, first opportunity, go out and kick Rashford on that ankle that he's been limping on." Owen defended his comments. This is what he's tweeted: "Hadn't realised there were so many angels here on Twitter. For everyone in uproar over my comments yesterday, get real." And another tweet he added: "Nobody was advocating giving Marcus Rashford a serious injury. He seems to have calmed down a little bit, it would appear." But he continues: "But with three subs already used, if his ankle was so uncomfortable he couldn't continue, then of course that would be discussed in every changing room in the land." So not much of a climb down for Michael Owen. He's doubled down on those comments and defended them.
Have you ever gone out to deliberately target a player who may be, you know, limping on one leg?
I think it's probably a decent enough strategy.
Who did you target?
No comment.
One example?
No, I think the problem is actually you could spend your whole second half focusing on trying to nail that one person and not actually concentrating on the ball.
Yeah, you miss every ball trying to hit him. Meanwhile, the GPA say they're disappointed that their motion to seek representation on the CCCC was defeated at GAA Congress over the weekend. The aim of Motion 31 was to give the GPA the right to nominate a representative for players to have a voice when it comes to fixing inter-county football and hurling matches. Their proposal received just 15% support from delegates on the floor in Wexford. A motion allowing the CCCC to have ultimate say on venues for home games, Motion 11 granted them that authority to approve ground subject to meeting health and safety requirements. In a statement, the GPA said the outcome of the vote on the GPA motion at Congress on Saturday was very disappointing. We feel this is an opportunity missed by the GAA. The GPA wants to play its part in helping to reform and improve fixtures, an issue that impacts very directly on our members and something that we all care passionately about. A seat at the CCCC would have allowed us to help shape that change.
We'll get more opinion on that in just a moment. Darren, is that you done?
One final story, and it concerns Conor McGregor's teammate Dylan Danis. Owen, he's been slapped with a 7-month suspension and a €7,500 fine for his role in the brawl that marred UFC 229. The fight started when Khabib Nurmagomedov jumped out of the octagon to confront members of McGregor's entourage after he defeated the Dubliner. McGregor was suspended for 6 months back in January, making him not eligible to compete until April. He was also fined $50,000. Nurmagomedov received a 9-month ban and fined $500,000.
Nice one, Darren. Thanks for that. Just another bit of information on the Brendan Rodgers story. The BBC are now on it. Chris McLaughlin tweeting that Brendan Rodgers is expected to leave Celtic after club giving permission to speak to Leicester. And as we can see there, the actual story there also goes with that story as well. So it seems that Brendan Rodgers is definitely done from Celtic and he's gone to chat to Leicester City. So we'd expect that to be done in the next few hours. And we are, as I say, turning to GAA next because Cara O'Kane will join us in a few moments. But first, Enda McGinley was getting stuck into Dublin on last night's show before he got interrupted by an unexpected visitor.
John Costello saying that, well, people weren't complaining 20 years ago. Well, things are very different on a large number of ways at the minute. In terms of him saying it was mean-spirited, I don't think it was. I think it was a sensible thing from Donegal. Donegal paid the brunt of it last year.
Have you ever seen the BBC show where the man's daughter comes into the room?
And she's eating a bag of crisps. They look like, and you know what? They're monster munch because she's licking her fingers.
Oh, she's coming again. Come back.
She's licking her fingers.
Hey,
how you doing?
A wave.
How's things?
Hi.
Up Tyrone. They're nice scripts.
For the radio audience watching,
sorry,
we presume Enda McGinley's daughter has just come in and started waving behind him on his Skype connection. She's gone now. She's sick of Dublin and Crow Park.
She actually says she was agreeing with you there.
I don't think I've ever seen David Brady as excited in my life. Loves Monster Munch. Right, we're going to chat about Congress. Here's a shortened version of Donegal Chairman Mick McGrath and former GAA President Sean Kelly on yesterday's OTB AM.
What your difficulty with were that the motion was divisive? Was that it?
Well, that type of wording was done, but people use words in their defence. Like, and I mean, we're big boys and it's a big world. We accept that we're big boys. It was probably some of the words that was used by Sean Kelly that if there was any divisiveness, it came from him, not from us. And we would have had a good enough relationship with him down through the years. And we weren't looking for any favouritism from anybody. We're only looking for one word: fairness. we don't feel that there's fairness in the motion at the moment, the way it stands. And that's why we brought it to Congress. But to say that we were negative, it was an addressing that the people from Donegal are negative. We're far from negative. And we at no stage are afraid or concerned with playing Dublin Croke Park.
I want to put something to you straight off the bat here. Mick McGrath said that he hoped that you would withdraw the word negative to describe the Donegal motion. And I've got to put that to you straight off the bat. Are you willing to withdraw the notion that it was a negative comment?
No, I'm not. I just commented practically on the wording of the motion. It was written in negative sense because it said no county could nominate Croke Park as their home venue. That's a negative. That's what I was talking about.
Is that not a little bit semantic, Sean, is that not a bit of a fig leaf for the people who voted against this, when ultimately what this means is that next year the competition will not be a fair competition? Dublin will have two home games in the Super 8, which gives them an unfair advantage against everybody else.
Yeah, but I suppose Croke Park has to be located in some county. It is located in Dublin, thankfully. Dublin can attract big numbers to the matches, and the games are played there. But I think if it was worded differently, which would make a big difference, would be, for instance, if they said that Dublin could play their home game in Croke Park, but the final game would be played in a neutral venue, then that would change the situation completely. Or, as I said, maybe we should look at playing one game at home, one game away, and toss for the final one. And then if they were to meet again subsequently in other years, that the team that was away would be at home the next time.
Do you buy that, Anthony?
Do I buy that? No, really. Listen, I was at Congress last year, and to say it is a... you kind of have to be... Have you ever been?
No, I haven't had the pleasure, no. Hmm. I probably would have gone if I was around at the weekend, to be honest, but just kind of see how it operates, because it is... So there is a mystique around Congress.
Yeah, there's a mystique around it. I was actually interested to see exactly, as you say, how it operates. And it's very much, I got the feeling that this is a lot of people's All-Ireland. You know, it is their weekend where there's a sense of responsibility and a sense of power and a sense of... But there's just so much stuff going on behind the scenes, and so much stuff going on in the build-up to it, which is actually very evident by a lot of kind of nearly structured things that happen and kind of nearly set things that happen, that you're kind of going, oh, I wonder why that individual is talking on this particular motion. But then you're kind of like, oh, now I see why that's going on. So there's a lot of nearly kind of things that are put in place. Obviously, people who are asked to speak on certain motions, which is fine, but there's definitely a serious amount of work that goes on behind the scenes to maneuver certain things in certain ways. Like, I don't know how many of the actual motions that were tabled by the top table got through, but I think it was practically all of them. I think it was. It nearly is every year. And they get through by like 90-odd percent, you know, for just straight away. If you bring anything, or if a club brings anything to it, or something like the GPA, or, you know, even ourselves, when we tried to get it through, the CPA, we tried to get it through various clubs for, especially last year, the transparency motion, which I think is the most ridiculously obvious thing to get. Never mind everything else. If you can't actually stand by and say, well, we want to see how everyone has voted. So if Owen has been mandated by Kerry to vote in this way, did he actually go and vote in that way? Like, that's as I said last year, that is the very, very basic requirement that you would think in a democratic situation. And that didn't go through. So what chances have you got really to know who votes what way? Some fella changed his mind. And you might say, oh, well, I listened to people argue over the 24 hours before the vote. Yeah, but hold on a second. You were still mandated to vote. And even if you did change your mind, well, at least go back to your county and tell them that you changed your mind. And then, you know, stand up for the fact that you did change your mind, and, you know, argue the point then to your representatives and to your clubs who actually mandated you in a certain way. It's extremely frustrating. It again seems to be that, you know, whatever is being dictated to, well, then that passes and the rest just kind of falls by the wayside. And, you know, you get a situation there like Sean Kelly. Like, that's a come down, you know. Like, I mean, he either thinks it is or it isn't, but don't say, oh, well, if you change the wording of it. Well, why wasn't there advice given then to change the wording of it? So by virtue of him saying, well, if you change the wording of it, he still thinks it's unfair. But he didn't. That wasn't his first point. Yeah. It wasn't about fairness. His first point was, Osher, Croke Park's in Dublin and that's where the games have to be played. So what is it about? Like, let's be straight about this. It's about the revenue. That is it. Like, I'd actually rather if someone came out and said, it's about the revenue, fellas. Because
that's the thing, because there is a nub of truth in that, that, you know, revenue is needed. But ultimately, the problem a lot of people have is just that that's not being given as the reason.
Exactly. Like, I mean, but again, it's like the Porky Creeve situation. Like, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. The thing that gets people so annoyed and so upset and frustrated about certain aspects of the GAA and how it's actually run is this kind of... nearly like treating you like an egot, you know, like kind of, there's this cloak and dagger stuff. Instead of actually coming out and saying, well, actually, I'll tell you what, it is about the revenue because Dublin will probably play whomever. They'll attract maybe 50 or 60,000 people into it. And that revenue then gets, you know, dissipated throughout the clubs in this manner. So people can actually say, oh, A to B to C, well, that's actually okay. So that's a good reason to have it, albeit it is a bit unfair on Donegal or Galway or whoever it may be. But at least the whole lot, the actual, you know, the game itself is improving underneath because of the revenue being dissipated, as they say. But when you kind of go, oh, no, well, it's just because of, you know, we don't see it at all about the revenue. It's about because there's crowds or whatever it is, or some of the stuff that's just being bandied about. That's where... it, people get really frustrated. And that's where people get annoyed at this kind of excuses that are put up without actually being completely truthful about it.
Yeah, like it seems that there would have been a much better chance of the Donegal motion of passing if it wasn't a Donegal motion, but say a central council motion.
Oh, 100%. Like, I mean, if it was. But you know, that's when you have a situation there. Like, I mean, John Costello stands up and says what he said. And as soon as he kind of brings that emotive language into it, you know, about being divisive, about being, you know, kind of mean-spirited. Straight away, that takes the eye away from the basic facts of the thing to an emotive thing now that, oh, Donegal are, sure, they're jealous of Dublin's, you know, superiority over there. Donegal, we're not saying anything like that. They weren't, like, I mean, if there's jealousy there, there's jealousy there. Or maybe there is in a small sense, but so is the rest of the country. It was about the basic fact of, especially the Donegal situation, where it was an unfair situation. It was unfair. And someone else is going to find themselves in the exact same situation this year and next year and the year after if it doesn't change.
Mm. I do want to ask you about the CPA element of Congress at the weekend. Yeah. There was a 20-minute fixture presentation. And I saw, I think it was the CPA account on Twitter.
Yeah.
Or was this Micheál Briody actually saying that there wasn't actually a great old take-up and actually watching this at a couple of delegates in the room and things like that?
Yeah, Micheál was there with John Keogh. The two of them were invited to it. And, you know, I think there was a 20-minute-odd presentation. About 50 or 60-odd people just left the room to relieve themselves or go for a pint or whatever it was. Obviously maybe feeling that, you know, there was no votes going to take part in this thing, or maybe that it just wasn't important enough. Now, personally, now you would think I would say this being part of the Club Player Association, but I would have thought that this would be a very important debate to have. Much more so, by the way, than a 15-minute debate that went on about when is the actual right time to send in an email. Is it 8 o'clock on a Monday morning or 9 o'clock on a Monday morning or 9:30 on a Monday morning when the school's open? Which, by the way, did occur. So there's lots of different stuff that goes on. Bit disappointed, and I suppose we'd be looking for clarification from the Uachtaráin's the speech which happened.
The quote that kind of jumped out was that he wanted the Club Players Association to submit a more detailed sample of how they propose to fill the blank canvas on fixtures, which they talk about to further enhance debate on the challenge around fixtures. We want solutions.
Yeah, so do we. You know, like, I mean, what we've been asking for since day one was a blank canvas to actually sit down with everyone, including the GPA, you know, all the stakeholders, to actually sit down and say, OK, let's try and sort this out once and for all. Like, I mean, we've come with reams of suggestions. You know, you have a situation where we've brought three different plans, you know, over the years. So you've Liam Griffin and his team have brought them. Derek Kavanagh along with them have brought. But, you know, there's always going to be holes picked in these things. But again, this is the type of thing where you come with something and someone say, oh, that doesn't work. We're not talking about that. The quote that Liam would have always said, it's not our plan or it's not what we think is right. You know, it's what is right for everyone. Mm. So to come out on that, I thought was a little bit disingenuous, very strange, because you know, behind the scenes, we've had some really good meetings with both Tom Ryan and John Horan.
When was the last time you met with them?
Members of the executive have met, like, only in the last number of weeks. You know, there's been 2 to 3 really good meetings even since the start of the year, in a sense of trying to move this thing forward and hopefully get an association or a committee set up to actually really finally have a look at this. You know, now, I think that's still in the pipeline, and we would hope it is very much so in the pipeline. But, you know, I just think that maybe, you know, I know it was a predetermined speech that he was making, but maybe he just made a mistake with regard to the language used, because I find it, again, as I say, and we would find it a bit disingenuous to think that we need to come with solutions. It was never about that. We're saying, listen, you could come with a solution, I could come with a solution, but it's not about our solution. It's about everyone sitting down and saying, okay, between all the stakeholders, as I said, the CCCC, the GPA, ourselves, whoever else, doesn't even matter. Mm. You need to get, obviously, you know, an agreement between everyone of how to progress this.
And, like, the first question is, like, how far away are we from that agreement? Like, have those meetings come close to kind of one similar solution? But also, how do you then make that work? Is it then that Central Council actually just takes control of the CPA idea, perhaps, and takes it to the next Congress because they've got the best chance of actually getting it through?
Yeah, hopefully. You know, whatever. I think, like anything, if we're brainstorming and we do it over a weekend or whatever it may be, you get, as I say, all the people in the room that actually will make a difference. You get maybe some people who are completely alien to the whole process to actually give a very independent view of it. But you come to a form of solution and you back it and you say, right, this is the way we're going to go. And then you would hope that, yes, it would be something that it would be brought by the top table. Because as I said to you, if it isn't at the top table, it very rarely gets in. Yeah. So the top table will have to obviously rubber stamp it and say, yes, this is something that we think is worth going for.
Cathal O'Kane of the Irish News is listening in this morning. Good morning to you, Cathal. How are things?
Morning, lads. Well, yourselves?
Good, thanks. We'll get into the weekend's football, but I just want to get your quick take on Congress on Saturday. Obviously, the Donegal motion falling flat. A lot of us maybe were a bit naive thinking this thing would actually go through, because it seemed to me that it would help the fairness of the competition. What's your take on this falling flat and whether or not it should have got through?
My take is, thank God I wasn't at Congress. The place is just, look, as a democratic body, it has become a complete shambles. It bears no resemblance to the public opinion. And ultimately, the idea of a democratic body is that that's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to reflect public opinion. Ultimately, the delegates that are going there to vote should be mandated. There shouldn't even be a need for Congress, you know, because they should be mandated by their clubs. The county boards could easily send off their votes on each motion to Croke Park. They could be counted up and everything could be sorted without the wicket. You know, the idea of having debate on the floor of Congress is, you know, it's wrong, because everybody should be going there already knowing what way they're going to vote on each motion, because they should have a mandate on what way they're going to vote. But as Anthony alluded to there, the transparency motion that was blown out of the water last year, I think it was 83% voted against it. To me, I think Congress completely lost all credibility at that point. The fact that such an overwhelming majority of the body of delegates voted against transparency in their own voting, it was just unbelievable. So there was no surprise, absolutely no surprise, that the Donegal motion went down. I think one motion from a club or county, and it was a fairly meaningless one, went through, and as Anthony said, almost everything from the top table did. So that's what it is.
I kind of forgotten how healthily that transparency motion was actually defeated last year, Cara. It's like we often kind of question when anything comes in the way of reform. The next question, obviously, is how is this thing going to get through Congress? And it seems there's a couple of ways to do it. But maybe the question we should actually be asking, Cara, is Congress fit for purpose?
No, it's not. It's not. I wrote about this on Monday, that it can't be deemed fit for purpose anymore, because it's not doing what it's supposed to do. And that's reflect the views of clubs and counties and everybody. You know, the delegates are going off their own bats. You know, they're not signing up to transparency in how they're voting. God knows how anybody is voting. But, you know, on the Donegal motion, it was very clear that, as Anthony said, the financial consideration was put in front of the money. Or, sorry, I'm put in front of the games. Sorry, I've got a wee visitor here again, the McKinley. The money was put in front of the games themselves, and it was just, you know, it was totally unsurprising that it happened. But you could be sure that if the voting was transparent, that, you know, that East Leinster belt that is under that coaching project, you can be sure that almost every one of those voted in favour of keeping Dublin and Croke Park because of the financial consideration that they had. You know, the integrity of the GAA's flagship competition, it had to come first in that decision. It just had to come first, and it clearly didn't. And that is where the body, you know, that's where Congress falls down. I think it falls down completely on that argument.
I think more and more, Cara, as you say, you know, and you go back to the transparency one last year, I think more and more county boards or people involved at the grassroots are going to become more and more emboldened by getting motions put up which are going to expose things more and more. Like, that is another one now, you know. And you can, and again, you can try to kind of, you know, pass it off and say, oh, well, this was going on and we have to consider the support base and you have to consider the fans and Dublin and all that. But it was a basic question. When you really boil it down, it was a basic question of fairness. The year before was a basic question of just transparency and democracy. And if you go, as Carr says, there is no... People were arguing, saying, but I should be allowed to change my mind. No, you shouldn't be allowed to change your mind. You've been mandated by every single person, shall we say, in your county to go and actually vote in a certain way. Why should you just decide that when you get there, because someone taps you on the shoulder and says X, that you say, actually, do you know what? You're right. That's a great idea. But if you do change your mind, go back then and stand in front of your county board and say, actually, I changed my mind. And that's why, as you can see, in a transparent situation, I changed my mind. I was meant to vote yes. I voted no. And here's my resignation.
The ironic thing, of course, is that if you don't want transparency, it's easy if you know you're one of 83%. It's like, well, you know, you can't really pick the needle from the haystack there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so it's...
But I think, you know, as Carol said, you may get... And this is really the only hope. But it's a very sad situation that if you continue to expose the underbelly, shall we say, of what's actually happening. Because I think people are either going to, A, get completely disillusioned, which is happening more and more. I can even hear in Carr there, you know, he's frustrated. Do you know what I mean? Like, I would never go again. Like, I left there last year and said to myself, there is absolutely no point. If we thought we had a motion and we thought, listen, we are... Because last year we said, let's do this to the nth degree. Let's do this absolutely the way you would bring every motion to it. We got someone to draft it up. We had, because by the way, even the language used around it is unbelievable. Like, I mean, it has to be in a certain specific manner, and then you have to go through a certain process to even get it on the floor. That in itself, by the way, is an arduous process. But when you do all of that, then it can just be kicked out. And by the way, you don't know who has voted which way.
Seems like there's a bit of PTSD for Congress goers. You're saying that you'll never go again. Did you see that Fire Festival documentary on Netflix a couple weeks ago?
No.
People saying, I'll never go to that festival again. It's kind of reminiscent of you talking
about Congress. I'm there next year knocking on the door, ready to go in.
We should talk about some of the stuff that's gone on the pitch over the past couple of days. Cathair, just your take first on an incredible result for Fermanagh, really, at the weekend against Donegal. I'm sure for somebody who's kind of watched them over the past couple of weeks, I'm not sure how surprised you were by this result, first of all, but it's certainly showing a progress that Rory Gallagher is bringing on the results front.
I was surprised. I think everybody was surprised, to be fair. To be honest, when Fermanagh went up, and I suppose that's been the way for them, and they've maybe used that. You know, last year when Rory Gallagher came in, people were sort of thinking they'd do well, consolidate their position in Division 3. They ended up promoted and ended up beating the Armagh side that they went up along with in the Championship, beating Monaghan in the Championship. And I suppose it fell down then in the Ulster final, and I suppose people were looking at that. And then you had the winter where they lost Seamus Quigley, they lost Tomás Corrigan. You know, they went into Donegal on Saturday. Pat Cadden, their first-choice goalkeeper last year, is gone. Mickey Jones, their sort of first-choice man marker, wasn't there. Barry Mulrone, sort of man of steel at wing half-back, wasn't there. Owen Donnelly, their, you know, Ulster captain in the last Real Wake Cup, wasn't there. And for them to go up to Letterkenny and come from... That was the biggest thing about it. They came from 8-3 down, which I think is the biggest sign of progress. And, you know, they get lambasted for maybe their style of football. There's no way in hell that they came from 8-3 down last year. You know, look at the Ulster final last year. They were set up absolutely plan A. Let's shut this game down. Let's keep this as tight as we can and maybe sneak it the way we did against Monaghan. Half an hour gone, it was 2:53, and the game was gone out the gate. And everybody in Clonus knew that day that there was no way back for Fermanagh because of the way they played. So to come from 8-3 down on Sunday, to keep Donegal to 2 points in the last 40-odd minutes of the game and go on and win it and score, what did they score? 9 themselves. That's the real achievement in it. And I think that's a level of progress they've made under Rory Gallagher. Like, it might not be pretty. People might not love to watch it, but players sign up for winning football, and that's what Fermanagh are playing at the minute. It's one of them games. Look at some of the counties that have similar resources flying around in Division 4 this 10, 20 years. Fermanagh don't have any better resources than any of them, and yet they're consistently punching above their weight, and they're doing so again.
What was the difference, Carr, do you think, with regard, like, when they went 8-3 behind, you know, from, say, this time last year? What did he change? What, you know, what has he brought in? Did they just kind of go for it a bit more? Because obviously they remained fairly tight at the back. But what was the difference for them, you know, from an attacking kind of point of view?
Well, structurally, defensively, it hasn't changed that much. I was up at their McKenna Cup game against Tyrone at the start of the year, and God, it was 2-2 at half time, and it was I can't even describe how bad a game of football it was, and yet, you know, they were setting that end of their game in place, you know, and they're very, very good at it. You know, they suck teams into the middle, and then they hit them. You know, they sort of leave spaces there, like, you know, a Venus flytrap. They leave a space in the middle, and then the second the ball goes in there, four of them surround it, and they batter the man, and they take it off him and turn him over, and it's brilliant, you know, from a defensive point of view to watch. But obviously they had to get better at the other side of the game. I think a big difference is, I suppose, look, they don't even have the attacking resources that they had last year. That's the thing about it. As I say, Seamus Quigley and Tomás Corrigan being gone are two big losses. Kieran Corrigan has put on a good bit of muscle over the winter, and has, you know, had played sort of corner forward almost as a, you know, as a foil to the Quigleys. He played corner forward for a couple of years. He's playing wing half back. He scored 4 points from play from wing half back at the weekend, which a massive boost for their attack. Aidan Breen is kind of that player that can play wing back, wing forward. He got a couple as well. You know, they're just a fluid, now they're a fluid running team. They're getting there in terms of playing that style of football. Like, they, you know, they will at times have all 15 behind the ball, but they're much more fluid now on the counter attack than they probably were this time 12 months ago.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about plan A and plan B there, because that was very striking, all right, last year, that how early the Ulster final was really over as a contest, because they didn't have a plan B to go to. And Keane O'Neill was actually speaking a couple of weeks ago after Kildare went down to Fermanagh, and it was a terrible game. It was very low scoring. But he was saying that they could identify what Fermanagh did. Fermanagh had their plan, and Kildare could do nothing to actually counteract it, which at the time I thought was actually a failure of Kildare. But maybe I'm wrong here, Cahir. Maybe this is actually just Fermanagh's strength, that they've, instead of, you know, building up a plan B, they've actually focus on plan A, and as Johan Cruyff famously always said, is like, instead of turning to plan B, make your plan A better. And maybe Gallagher's gone down the same route.
Absolutely. He said, you know, I remember talking to him before the Ulster final last year, and his quote was that, you know, when he came in and found a group of players whose confidence was very low. You know, the last year, Pete McGrath's reign hadn't gone well. They weren't probably getting the best out of themselves at all. And he said, you know, given the resources in Fermanagh, there are no great minor teams coming behind. You know, there's not a great, you know, an average of one Ulster final every 20 years has been their history, and they've never obviously won one in that time. So he said that it's really a 6, 7, 8 month project to get better. To, you know, they maxed out on one gym session a week because they wanted to focus on their tactical awareness, on getting the basic skills a bit better, and on the defensive end of the game and getting themselves organised again. So you're absolutely right that they have zoned in. Like, plan A, I mean, anybody who watches the Armagh and Monaghan games back from last summer that they played, you know, the Monaghan game, God, they didn't get enough credit for what a defensive masterclass that was that day. You know, they took everything that Monaghan had done against Tyrone, they unpicked it, and they set themselves up to be horribly hard to beat, and they did enough on the break. They probably did get a benefit of a few refereeing decisions in the first half, if I recall, and then they obviously get the fisted goal at the end. So there's wee bits of fortune that they're going to need when they're playing that style of football, but you have to put that against how far above their weight in terms of resources that they're punching, and you have to give it that context, and in that context they're doing an outstanding job.
We were speaking at the top of the show, Cathair, about a potential early Manager of the Year award when it comes to Gaelic football, and Rory Gallagher was in the conversation. We can actually bring up the current poll results. You can get it at Off the Ball on Twitter, and he is currently winning. He's on 36% of the vote. Second place is Mickey Graham with 24% of the vote, even though I said he should be out of the top four. Andy McEntee with 21%, and Wayne Kieran's in fourth place on 19%. Molsey, are you happy with those results?
Represents
your own view?
Yeah.
Before we'll come back to that and we'll give you the final result before the end of the show, just before we let you go, Cara, just a quick word on Tyrone against Monaghan. Big win for Tyrone at the weekend. I'm not sure, you might have been surprised about this one as well. Are they back on track now, is that fair to say?
I think we need to see a couple more games from Tyrone to say that they're back on track, because of the fact that Monaghan were so far below their own standard on Saturday night. You know, it was so uncharacteristic of Monaghan. I'd be a wee bit concerned that Monaghan have just gone badly off the boil. They were 2 points against Galway over a long period of time with the wind was not a good return from them. They went up to Tyrone. For 20 minutes, Conor McManus looked like he might beat them on his own. He was outstanding, but the supply completely dried up after that. And Tyrone, to be fair to them, right from the very first minute, right from the very start, had looked a lot sharper and a lot more at it. They moved Matty Donnelly to full forward, which was a big point in the game. You know, he had been playing as a sweeper, well, at the start of this season and over the last couple of seasons. He had floated to full forward a couple of times over the last couple of years. But I think that they need that focal point in their attack. He gave them that. You know, in terms of, they didn't score, but in terms of their kick passing game, which, you know, people talk about them as a running team, Tyrone's kick passing game over the last 18 months has developed hugely.
Yeah.
And they're very, very good at it now. And Matty Donnelly and Cathal McShane have become the focal point of that winning ball. If they can get scores off that, like Peter Hart was outstanding, sort of centre-half forward. And so, look, they did the same last year. They had an awful start. They ended up finishing fourth in the league, comfortable enough, ended up in the All-Ireland final. So I think people writing them off were a bit premature after the first couple of games. But equally, I'd want another couple of games just to see exactly where they're at in terms of what they're doing.
Yeah, nice one, Cara. We'll let you go and we'll chat to you soon. Thanks a million for that.
Thanks, man.
You actually said that exact thing a couple of weeks ago, that just chill out a little while. Tyrone did this thing last year.
Yeah. Well, they did it. It's a carbon copy. You know, it's like they kind of take the first couple of games to try, well, let's try something completely different. All the while he knows he's got the certain individuals to just put back into the system and change it slightly. And that's all he has to do. I think the Matty Donnelly to full forward is a really good idea, by the way.
Yeah, it really is. It seemed to have paid dividends for them at the weekend as well. Like, from a Monaghan perspective then, a bit of a setback. Like, are you a little bit worried about them in terms of getting relegated from Division 1?
Yeah, like, I mean, they kind of, you know, people would look, oh, you know, they bet Dublin, but they got Dublin at a really good time. You know, that was a great time to get them. And, you know, where they got them, obviously at home. I would be worried. You know, that's the manner of the defeat of the weekend was the more worrying thing. Great start, McManus looked great, but then they were just shut down and it was like, okay, where do we go from here?
Right.
And I just don't see that. I don't see the threats.
Are they a bit of a plan A team as well?
I think they are. And I think a lot of teams can say, right, okay, more so with Tyrone, who can mix it up and who've got a lot of different pace and power coming from different areas and who have obviously tried to add. You can see O'Neill's idea. Like, he was very much an inside forward who had great vision and who could drift out and play balls. And I'd say that's kind of the role they're thinking of. Donnelly, sit inside, pick off balls, but then if needs be, just drift out and look to supply passes, which O'Neill used to do. I would be worried about Monaghan, though. Yeah, I am. And it's not a nice place if they get relegated, because I think Ulster, again, with the Cavan, Donegal coming, Fermanagh coming, Tyrone there, you know, Derry even improving, Armagh improving. Ulster's going to be very, very tight this year.
Yeah, it certainly is. We may get your take as well on Dublin Mayo before we wrap up a little bit later on, but we've got confirmation that that Brendan Rodgers has been allowed to talk to Leicester City this morning. It looks like he's going to leave Celtic. And to talk about this, we've got Tom English on the line. Good morning to you, Tom.
Good morning.
What's your initial take on this from, I guess we'll start with the Leicester side of things, in terms of them going after Brendan Rodgers? It had been touted that he'd been linked with the job over the last couple of days. Are you surprised, first of all, that he's decided to actually kind of leave the club and actually have a word with Leicester?
I'm surprised that he's about to leave mid-season. That's a little bit of a surprise. The fact that he is leaving is not a surprise at all. In fact, back in December, this was mooted. That he was going to, because Puel has been in trouble for quite a while now at Leicester. It isn't a surprise. It isn't a surprise that he's leaving for Leicester. It's an appealing job. They've got a lot of money, a lot of ambition, a stable club. He wants to go back into the Premier League at some point. He's done everything he can do at Celtic. The only thing that would have kept him at Celtic is if he got a big budget to try and kick on in Europe. That's never going to happen. So what else can he do where he is? He needs to move on. He's an ambitious guy. He needs to move on and for a new challenge.
Yeah, was there a chance almost that he felt that if he'd stayed another season or so, that there was a chance that his stock might have fallen? Because obviously after what happened in his Celtic stint so far, his stock has certainly recovered a good bit.
It has. Well, it has, yeah. I mean, it has. He's won 7 trophies out of 7. He's on the verge, or would have been on the verge, of winning a treble. But, you know, Europe, he's got Celtic into the group stage of the Champions League twice, but they haven't done well at all. They haven't done well in the group stage of the Europa League this time. So in Europe, he hasn't done it. But domestically, he's won everything. So I think if he was to stay, I would imagine it would have felt quite repetitive for him. I know a lot of Celtic fans were really kind of buying into the notion that Brendan Rodgers was here for 10 in a row, this fabled 10 in a row that Celtic are going for. They're only on 7 in a row now, but if they get 10 in a row, that creates all sorts of history. He was never going to stay for 10 in a row. That's another couple of seasons after this one. I mean, Brendan Rodgers is a hugely ambitious guy. He's made no secret of that. He's loved the job he's done, but everyone here suspected that as soon as a good Premier League job or a job in Spain, fluent Spanish speaker, would like to work in Spain, one of those jobs came up that he was going to go, and he's about to go.
Yeah, it certainly seemed that the Celtic job had taken Brendan Rodgers as far as he could go. Like, it seems a ridiculous question to ask. Did Brendan Rodgers take Celtic as far as they could go? But you mentioned the European failings over the past couple of seasons. Is there still another couple of inches this team can go forward with the right appointments?
Listen, say that again, sorry.
Is there still scope for improvement for Celtic under a different manager?
Well, in Europe, I think there is. I mean, Neil Lennon is going to come in as interim manager till the end of the season, so Celtic can figure out in the summer what they want to do. Neil Lennon, in Europe, punched above his weight, beat Barcelona, pushed Barcelona into a 2-1 loss at Camp Nou, last-minute goal for a winner for Barcelona. Brendan Rodgers has never got those type of results in Europe. But then Neil Lennon never got the type of results that Brendan Rodgers got domestically. So I think if Neil Lennon comes in for the rest of the season, Celtic might be weaker domestically because he was very consistent at Celtic, but he never had the consistency that Brendan Rodgers had. And the one set of fans here that would be euphoric at the moment to Rangers, and or maybe two sets of fans, Aberdeen, because they're not that far away from Celtic in the league table.
Yeah. In terms then, and a final point, Tom, in terms of the evolution of Brendan Rodgers over the past couple of seasons, the post-Liverpool Brendan Rodgers, what have you seen and what can Leicester City fans expect?
I think under Puyol, from what I can understand, Puyol was a pretty dour, deflating character, incapable of motivating the dressing room and playing pretty rigid football. Brendan Rodgers will be a big motivator. He'll be a big presence in that dressing room, and he'll want them to play the type of football that they played under Ranieri when they won the league. He will go back to that. So I think they will get a character who will bring the thing alive again with the force of his personality. And I think that's what, from my understanding, that's exactly what Leicester need, because Leicester have a decent set of players. I mean, I think they're in a false position, but they're in the position. They're only 8 points off the relegation zone. But for the players that they have, I don't think they should be there. And I fully expect Brendan Rodgers to get them back up that table again.
Tom, thanks a million for taking the call.
Pleasure.
Tom English there of the BBC reacting to the breaking news that Brendan Rodgers has been allowed to talk to Leicester City. It seems that he's set to leave his role as Celtic manager. So Manchester United and Liverpool drew nil-all on Sunday. Kevin Kilbane and Nathan, they also looked ahead after the game to the midweek slate of Premier League fixtures, which kick off tonight.
So looking ahead to a really busy week now in the Premier League, Liverpool a point ahead of Manchester City. Are you just happy if this time next week when we're leaving Goodison Park as a Liverpool supporter, if you're still top of the league, is that just the sole aim now?
Yeah, of course it is. You know, all that is
take every game as it comes.
Do performances matter? Like, do they need to put on a performance against Watford, or do they just need 3 points, win that game 1-0, scrape a goal, it doesn't matter? Or do they need to go out and set out their stall?
No, I'd probably say they need to put in a performance like they were showing 2 months ago, whatever it will be. You name a performance, you name a game where Liverpool were free-flowing and they were really creating a lot of chances in games. I think they've got to do that. I think they've got to get that real vibe around Anfield again and put a team to bed. Now, Watford, the form that Watford are in, this is going to be a tricky one because Watford will drop a bit deep. They've got real pace. They've got real aggression within their side as well that could hurt Liverpool, particularly from set pieces. I think I saw today a little bit of a vulnerability, the way that Liverpool were playing a high line, and a couple of times United nearly got in on it. That's certainly something that Watford will look at and think, right, let's try and have a plan how we're going to get in from Liverpool playing a high line from wide free kicks. That's certainly something to look at. But I think they need a performance, Liverpool. I really do. And if I'm Marco Silva and I'm looking ahead to that Merseyside derby next week, and I'm in that dressing room playing for Everton, I'm thinking, right, these are not in great form. This can redeem our season in many respects. It has to be, because Everton have been dreadful. Now they have to get something, get some pride back in that blue jersey. And I think if I'm an Everton player at Goodison Park next week, I'm going to fly out the traps and get into them. That's what I want to do. I want to stop them playing. And I think we may see a better Merseyside derby than we saw today. Yeah.
Yeah, Nathan and Kev at Old Trafford there on Sunday. Bernard on YouTube has been in touch to ask, what about Keno for Celtic manager? It's an interesting suggestion there to replace Brendan Rodgers. He was just joining us. It seems that he is going to leave Celtic. He's been given permission to talk to Leicester City to replace Claude Puel as manager there. Right, to tell you about our competition now, as Ireland prepare for their penultimate Guinness Six Nations clash against France at the Aviva Stadium on Sunday week, official partner Dove Men Plus Care is giving you the chance to be part of the captain's run. The winner will join the IRFU kitman John Moran as he prepares the dressing room for the Irish rugby team ahead of their final training session before the big game. And if that wasn't enough, the winner will also receive a pair of tickets to see Ireland against France at the Aviva the following day. To be in with a chance to win, just tell us what your favourite rugby jersey is. Tweet us or comment where you're watching the show, and make sure you use the hashtag TeamCare and hashtag OTBAM so that we know you've entered. We've had a couple of great suggestions. We've had a couple of bad suggestions. Let's run through a couple of them here. This is France 2015's home jersey. I like that.
Yeah, I like it.
Like that a lot.
Yeah, France have always had some really, really class ones.
Yeah, they really have. They know how to do it. To be fair, oh, this one.
Whoa.
Wow, okay, 2007, Ireland. Not great.
Whoa, not that's great. Actually sore in the eyes.
I think that's actually the last one I owned, but it was a green version of that, which I think was a bit better. That is...
Was that the World Cup in France?
Yeah, that maybe that's why it was such a disaster. Yeah. Saracens, this is the current-ish one, I think. It's a nice enough jersey, I'm not sure. I think that's a bit of a Marmite jersey, isn't it?
Yeah.
Love it or you can hate
really,
it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be a fan.
Leinster 2001 then. Oh, this is the All Blacks. You can't beat the All Blacks.
Nah,
like they, to be fair, the All Blacks have it too easy.
Yeah,
they just
do,
have it too. It's just black and white.
Just keep it simple.
Exactly. Adidas get no marks for creativity, and this is Leinster. Whoa! Come on, sold out everywhere. They say that is
nice pair of baggy Levi's with that there now, and away you go. You can go anywhere with that jersey.
Jeans and shoe. This is Super Rugby kit from the 2016 Jaguars. Nice.
Cool.
I like that as well. Again, an easy color scheme, and then it's just a classic like France. Oh, yeah. It, like, 9 times out of 10, you'll get a top-quality France jersey. Like, on any other jersey, those sleeves would be ridiculous and ambitious.
Absolutely.
And really bring down the overall quality. But on this French jersey, like, you can throw anything you want at a French jersey. And
good blast of rain on that, and you literally, it would weigh about a stone on you.
This is obviously 09. This is, like, the sort of white outline on that Ireland jersey.
Yeah, I wasn't big into that.
No, I think they've sort of improved the Ireland jersey over the last couple of years. Like they
just keep it green.
Well, it seems that way. Like you can take the model of the French and All Blacks jerseys, and what have they done? They've taken their block colour and they've just done very little with it.
Exactly.
And I think maybe
like I don't like look at the white trim at the bottom there.
Mm. Needless.
Needless.
I would
Stephen Ferris doesn't seem to have, by the way, on his.
That's a good point, actually. Mm. Inconsistency in the Ireland jersey.
Oh, there we
that's
go.
Like.
Someone in the marketing and the department has to get shot. Maybe he wasn't playing, was he?
That's a remarkable difference, right? You would get top marks on a spot the difference quiz. We've got a tweet in here from David Kelly saying, a journalist once asked Mickey Graham what it's like to be manager of the year this far. He replied, I don't know. You'd have to ask Rory Gallagher. So there you go. That seems to be the way that Roy Gallagher is going to win our poll for Manager of the Year so far from the National Football League. Just before we go, Anthony, just get your take quickly on what happened in Croke Park on Saturday night. We talk about surprising performances from the weekend there with Cahir. I think Mayo's performance shocked a few of us. Or maybe we were all too naive to actually say that this Mayo team is really on track to get back to where they were a couple of years ago.
I think it was two things, really. They actually had chances in the first half, and I think they just kind of got to a situation where when they didn't take those chances, it really started to kind of, you know, take their confidence away. Keegan obviously got the black card. I just think a number of things kind of compounded them. What it seemed to me was they went in to play Dublin and Croke Park, and an awful lot of them either A, weren't confident enough of the system that they were playing, or B, weren't confident enough of all of the players around them, because it was an awful lot of individualism going on. Serious amount. If you watch the goal that Costello gets, where he stands up Keith Higgins, you know, and he kind of drops the ball. Remember, and he was going to go right, then he drops it and he kind of flicks it up with his head. But he's probably, Higgins has him standing. Like as a defender or anyone, you know, if I'm managing that, you're saying, listen, your first job is to stand him, try and make sure that he doesn't go around you quick, make him make a few decisions, and then help will arrive. But no help arrived. Colin Boyle was standing probably about only 10 metres away and never actually sprinted over to actually help. There's another occasion, because Dublin are doing this a lot, Merchant comes up the sideline, and you know all he's going to do is dish the ball off. Mannion comes out, I think, or Kilkenny. He plays him a little pop pass. Again, Boyle is standing in the middle. Should have been able to read it. He would come around on the loop and kick it with his right foot. Never makes the effort to get over and double up. Now, that is Boyle thinking, am I confident enough to do that, or is he going to switch it in here, you know, to my man behind me? And that's just a breakdown in system. That's a breakdown in confidence that I know I can actually go and help you out because someone's going to help me out. And I felt that really happened a lot of times in their defence. And it was probably the cause of about 1-2, 1-3, 1-4. Dublin only kicked, what, 1-12? Mm. So a lot of that came from, I suppose, a little bit of indecision. As I say, a lack of confidence in probably, or a lack of belief in what they were trying to do. And in a defence, obviously when you're playing against Dublin, especially with Kilkenny back, because I think he's imperative to their game. I think he's probably by far, you know, I was a bit on the fence with him, but I really saw over the first few games how much he's missed as a ball carrier. Mm. And he plays this thing like in basketball where he swings the ball from left to right. You know, he keeps the defence moving. The defence has to shift.
The pendulum effect.
Yeah, correct. And he is unbelievable at that, because either he never loses the ball. Like, he's so physically strong. He's like a bull at the moment. Like, if you see him, his back, his neck. Like, I mean, he's just absolutely... So he's so strong on the ball, and Callaghan has got stronger. Mm. Wow. Like, I mean, he took on a few fellas the other night and it looked like they had them, and he just burst past them. He just fired them out of his way. I wouldn't be too worried about Mayo. I wouldn't be too worried. I think Horan, it was interesting to hear him straight after saying we weren't up to the pace of it and we got bullied. Interesting comment to say that. That's something that he can stick in the back pocket and show them and say you were bullied by Dublin. Because they've never been bullied. You know, no matter what you say about Mayo, they've never really been bullied by Dublin. If anything, they've kind of stood up and nearly kind of done the bullying to Dublin. So they've never been bullied by them. They may have been outclassed by them or just, you know, beaten by the bounce of a ball or whatever it is. So that was an interesting comment for him to make. He looked fairly despondent after it. But I think when they sit back and they actually analyse it, I think they say, right, we need to tidy up on certain things going forward, our shot selection, different stuff like that. But also that fulcrum at six and the idea of doubling up. You have to double up with Dublin. You have to make them go back out. You actually have to make them get the ball back out to Kilkenny and continue for him just to go left and right. Anything that comes in here has to nearly go back out, if you get me. You can't allow Mannion and these guys perform inside, or Costello for that matter, and stand up one-on-one with players. Mm. You're asking for trouble there.
Like, the irony here is that a couple of weeks ago we were saying it doesn't matter about Dublin not winning the league, because Jim Gavin perhaps doesn't care about the league this year, and they're probably going to make the league final and they're probably going to win it. That's what's going to happen here over the next couple of weeks, isn't it? They're only 2 points off Mayo now at this point, so like they're well within shooting distance of actually making the league final.
They are well within shooting distance, and you know, yeah, like, I mean, he'll probably... He wanted a reaction, obviously, and he got that reaction. Although I wasn't that massively impressed with him. You know, I wasn't massively impressed with them. I think...
That makes it even scarier.
Yeah, I think they're starting to show... Like, if I was trying to get a team set up against them, they're starting to show patterns of play which are very repeatable.
Right.
Right? Very repeatable. How,
what are we talking here? Is it the pendulum movement you're talking about?
Pendulum here? Movement, also the movement of, you know, create the space for the halfback or cornerback coming up who has absolutely no intention of kicking the ball over the bar. His idea is that he's coming up and he's looking for a player to come off his shoulder and pop the pass to him. And he will either take the shot on or he will look to pass it to the next man coming in support of him. Now, it takes a lot to stop that because you need a player with a runner, you need the corner back, you need someone else coming over to help out as he comes out on the loop, and you need to pick up players coming in support. But it can be done if you're diligent enough and determined enough and obviously fit enough to do it. But as regards, I think you still need to bring back Dublin to a situation that they're giving the ball to a person that they don't necessarily want to take shots. That's what you have to try to do.
Who are those people?
Well, it's definitely not Mannion and it's not Rock, okay? Although you can, again, I've seen even Dean Rock over the last number of weeks being pushed onto his so-called weaker foot and struggling a little bit with it. You've seen McMenamin before being pushed onto his weaker foot, has worked on it, but 9 times out of 10 it just hasn't gone there for him. So, like, I mean, you probably just want to get the ball to guys who are not as prolific. So you nearly want them to go back out, as I say, and give a ball out to, say, McCauley. Fenton, to be fair, chips in with a score or two. But you're nearly trying to push them back onto their half-back line. And Kilkenny can score, but his primary role at the moment is to try to punch those holes and try to swing the ball, as you say, pendulum effect, and try to find gaps. Listen, I'm not saying it's easy. It's not easy. But I'm just noticing that there's certain patterns of play which are very repeatable, that if you break it down and you show a defence, you can say, right, this is a setup here that they're doing 4, 5, 6 times in a game. We have to be ready for this. We have to be aware that when it's happening in the game, that this is what's going to occur. So we all have to be ready for that, be diligent on it, know where the ball is going to come and know where we want to put the ball. You know where we want to actually have the ball. We don't want the ball in this area. We want to try to push the ball out to a different area. They're not as direct, you know, as in, like when Bernard Brogan was in there, they were much more direct. You know, they were much more quick ball in, you know, one, runners off. They're much more kind of, they run with the ball a bit more now and they look for the players coming on the loop. So it's all about ball retention and ball protection. And then, as I say, they try to find the gaps. But it's definitely, like, it's interesting what Carr is saying about Tyrone. Dublin have become very much a running fullback and halfback line team. Very much so. And midfield. You know, they're not as like, I remember spoke to you a couple of weeks ago when I was talking about, I saw Paul Flynn coming on last year and he came on the pitch and he looked up one of the first balls he got underneath the Hogan stand and he hit this kind of 30, 40 yard ball off the outside of his boot and Jim Gavin took off his hat and fired it on the ground. Now, it went to the opposition. It was a kind of a 50-50. But Gavin, I've never seen Gavin show any emotion. And that was a massive bit of emotion for him. Like, he was absolutely livid with it. And I kind of remember thinking about it and I said, that's not the type of play that he wants. He doesn't want those 50-50s. He doesn't even want 60-40s. He wants 80-20s. He wants me literally running to you and passing the ball into your chest and you then retaining the ball and us trying to wear down a defence or tire them out or wait for gaps or get frees.
It's very interesting stuff. It seems that the analysis on Dublin has become a little bit easier for teams, but actually executing that is as difficult as it's ever been.
Executing it is. But that's why, you know, not to fast forward, but that's why Kerry, like, you need, what the thing has mightily impressed me about Kerry, never mind going forward, it is their tenacity in defence. It is their one-on-one and their ability to double up, even at the weekend, again ferocious, you know, as regards their intensity to work off the ball and keep linked with players and then also get fellas over to help. Like, the ability, it's so difficult to actually, as sometimes, for everyone to decide, you know, you're in trouble. As soon as the ball goes to you, I am going hell for leather to double up with you. Even if you allow that split second, you know, the forward can cause damage. And I have to say that was mightily impressive. And I think Keane has noticed that is what really needs to be done. Like, you think back of Mayo having Dublin under pressure. It was that idea of that white, like, red hot in defence. You're really trying to pressure them and put them into situations where
they're on the wrong foot and they're taking pot shots, because Dublin forwards will still have a go, you know. And what you want is the confidence just being chipped away. And once the confidence is chipped away, all of a sudden it starts to impact.
You're getting a glimmer of hope to the anti-five in a row brigade here this morning, Anthony.
Glimmer.
Thanks, Millie, for coming in.
No bother at all.
Off the Ball is back on the radio tonight from 7 o'clock with a Kelly Harrington interview. Tommy Welsh will be on to talk about the weekend's hurling and the latest on Brendan Rodgers as well on the Football Show, of course. And we're back tomorrow morning on OTBAM from 7:45 a.m. Johnny Sexton is going to join us for an in-studio chat about the 2019 Six Nations thus far and much more to you, as well, as you can imagine. Anthony, thank you very much again.
And,
we'll see you tomorrow morning. Bye-bye for now.
So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTBAM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTBAM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.